Time now for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, the Indians fighting for Russia in Ukraine and America's efforts to get people onto trains in cities where the car is king. But first we go to Tunisia and the case of an imam who had been living in France for nearly 40 years but who was expelled after making unacceptable remarks about the French flag. Imam Mahjoub Mahjoubi appeared to call the French flag satanic in a video that went viral online. He was deported to Tunisia. From Tunis, Rory Mulholland sent this report.
If you're a Muslim in France, you no longer have freedom of speech. That was what a French lawyer told me recently after his client, an imam who lived and preached in a small southern town near Avignon, was deported back to his native Tunisia. The affair made many headlines and sparked further debate about whether France and President Emmanuel Macron's government was lurching further to the right, or indeed the far right, in a bid to contain Marine Le Pen's growing popularity. Not all French would agree with the lawyer's assessment of the case. Many here think it was right to expel Imam Mahjoub Mahjoubi because of the content of his sermons, which the government said went against the secular and egalitarian values of the French Republic. The official order for Majubi's expulsion said that in sermons in February, he gave a retrograde, intolerant and violent image of Islam that encouraged discrimination against women, tensions with the Jewish community and jihadist radicalization. The imam was also accused of sharing a video of a sermon in which he described tricolour flags, without, however, specifying if he meant the French flag, as satanic and having no value in the eyes of Allah. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin crowed that the imam's rapid expulsion was a sign that France's hardline new immigration law, which Marine Le Pen's party hailed as an ideological victory for themselves, was doing what it was supposed to do. But critics pointed out that the imam could have been deported under existing legislation and that Darmanin had simply ordered Imam Mahjoubi's expulsion to make himself look good. They argue that while Mahjoubi's sermons did indeed promote pious and conservative values that might jar with the officially secular French, there was nothing in them that incited violence or rejection of Republican values. That was also my conclusion when I listened to them on the Facebook videos the imam posts of his preaching. The reference to women and Jews that I heard were taken from the Prophet Muhammad's hadiths or sayings that discussed the end of the world. The hadiths say that Muslims will, at that apocalyptic time, destroy Jews and others they see as infidels who are led by a false messiah. It's arguably bad timing and inappropriate for a Muslim preacher to dwell on such matters when France, which is home to Western Europe's largest Muslim and Jewish populations, is bitterly divided over the conflict in Gaza. But equally potentially offensive teaching is to be found in the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, which, for example, describes homosexuality as an abomination. So throwing a man out of the country he has lived in for 40 years and where his wife and children still live for relaying religious scripture might be seen as a little harsh. I went to the town of Bagnols-sur-Cèze to talk to the imam's followers at his mosque. They included one young man with a Scouser accent. He grew up in Birkenhead, and they all said that they had never once heard their imam say anything negative about France. On the contrary, they said, he had often denounced the many deadly Islamist attacks in France in recent years. That was also what Imam Mahjoubi himself told me when I travelled to Tunis to talk to him in the house of his relatives where he's now staying while he fights the extradition order in the French courts. He was in tears as he spoke of what he saw as the brutal manner in which he was so quickly expelled from the country he says he loves and whose values he respects. He agreed that some imams in France deserve to be shut down as they preach hatred and jihad. But he insists he never did anything of the sort and preached only tolerance and devotion. Such expulsions are likely to continue. The government will argue that they are part of the crackdown on what it calls separatist attempts by some Muslims to live apart from wider French society. Critics and many Muslims see them, however, as the supposedly centrist Macron government pandering to the far right and growing increasingly anti-Islam. For World Report, this is Rory Mulholland in the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
Next, a story about two Indians who were killed fighting alongside Russian forces in Ukraine. They landed at the front lines after they were recruited as helpers for the Russian army, but were forced to become combatants against their will. Nearly 100 poor and jobless Indians who were lured to Ukraine by agents offering attractive salaries are now desperate and want to return home. The Indian government has approached the Russian authorities to get them back, as Sajida Momin reports.
The heat of the Russian-Ukraine war, raging for over 2 years now, was suddenly felt in India this month with the arrival of coffins from Moscow in New Delhi bearing the bodies of Mohammad Afsan and Hemal Ashwinbhai Mangukia. The two Indians were killed fighting alongside Russian soldiers at an obscure battlefront in faraway Europe, thousands of miles away from their homes in Hyderabad and Surat, in India's Telangana and Gujarat state. The Indians killed in the Ukraine war are no mercenaries or soldiers of fortune glamorized in films and novels. Investigations by the Hindu newspaper has revealed that they were duped into fighting alongside the Russian army by unscrupulous recruiters in India and the United Arab Emirates, who hired them as helpers and porters for Russian defense forces, promising astronomical salaries and a citizenship of Russia and other European countries on expiry of their contract. But they were ultimately forced to handle arms and take part in the Ukraine war as combatants against their wishes, eventually resulting in their death on the battlefield. By the Modi government's own admission, around 20 to 25 Indians are still stuck there after they were tricked into joining the Russian army. A spokesperson for India's External Affairs Ministry has been quoted by the media saying that Russian authorities have been contacted to get all of them discharged and repatriated. But according to unofficial accounts, the number of Indians stuck at the Russia-Ukraine border is around 100. Social media is flooded with videos of groups of Indians working for Russian security forces, pleading with Prime Minister Modi and External Affairs Minister S. Jaishankar to come to their aid and somehow get them released and arrange their passage home. Their families and relatives are also repeatedly appealing to the government to ensure their safe return to India. The Indians stuck in Russia are not from a single region, but were recruited from several states ranging from Jammu and Kashmir in the north to Tamil Nadu in the south, exposing the magnitude of the hiring racket which lured them into fighting at the front against their will. It was only after reaching Russia that they realized they had not been recruited for support roles, but to be trained as soldiers to fight for Russia in Ukraine. It took weeks before Mohammed and Hemal's bodies were flown to New Delhi from Moscow on March 16. But after they were killed in the battlefield, India's Central Bureau of Investigation swung into action to bust the recruitment racket. The CBI conducted searches at 13 locations, including New Delhi and Mumbai, and found that agents of an organized network were using social media channels such as YouTube to lure gullible youth to travel to Russia by promising them lucrative jobs. It found that around 35 Indians had fallen victim to the racket and were deployed at the war front, putting their lives in grave danger. After the raids and arrests for human trafficking, the External Affairs Ministry advised all Indians to exercise due caution and steer clear of war zones. Hemal was only 23 years old and worked in the family's small textile shop in Surat before he fell prey to recruiters. His family saw him off on December 14th at Mumbai Airport, from where he travelled to Chennai before going to Russia via Dubai. He last spoke to his father on February 20th from a military dormitory in Russian-occupied Donetsk region of Ukraine, where he was killed in a missile strike 2 days later. Like Hemal, 30-year-old Mohammed, too, belonged to a poor family. The Hyderabad resident became a victim of job fraud in his desperation to break the shackles of poverty and lead a comfortable life. He was killed in an explosion in Donetsk on January 27th, the Indian embassy in Moscow announced on March 6th. At the bottom of the unfolding tragedy lies an uncomfortable and undeniable truth. Although the Indian economy is growing and is poised to become the third largest in the world, with Modi pulling out all stops to attract businesses and foreign investors, unemployment still remains high and is fueling the overseas migration of workers. According to the World Bank, nearly 18% of Indians between the age of 15 and 24 are jobless, driving the exodus of able-bodied men to foreign shores to earn their livelihood. Joblessness and economic distress are also responsible for illegal immigrants from India risking their lives to break into countries like the United States and the United Kingdom. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Finally, to the United States, getting a bus or public transport in many American cities remains elusive, as the car is still king of the road. However, a recent decision by the US government means funding will be provided to improve rail transport between major cities, as Mark Godfrey found out when he visited Columbus, Ohio.
Outside the sprawling Eastern Mall on Columbus's north side, I asked how to get a bus into the city centre. My question was met with polite shrugs and some head scratching. Nobody was able to tell me because no one appeared to have taken public transport to one of the biggest malls in Ohio's largest city. Columbus is one of the fastest growing cities in America and the epitome of sprawl and an approach to urban planning that puts the car first. Figuring it'd be a good place to get some insight from homeowners and builders, I've visited the local DIY superstore called Lowe's. Getting there was an eye-opener in itself. When I crossed the road from the Eastern Mall, I realized there was no pedestrian access points to the smaller shopping center where Lowe's was located. Cars only, I thought, as I climbed a hedge into the parking lot after dodging motorists. This is the kind of car-centered planning continental European cities have been moving away from, in favor of density and public transport to reduce carbon emissions. At Lowe's, an engineer called Dennis explained how City Hall has prioritized growing the city's boundaries to grow the tax base. When I looked at the local transport budget, I understood why it's so hard to find a bus in the Columbus suburbs. The city spends $3 per capita on public transport, compared to a national average spend of $59. $70 per person is spent on roads. The Central Ohio Transit Authority says it operates 444 buses on 41 bus routes. That sounds like a serious network. But then you look at the sprawl of Columbus and you realize this is a threadbare service. Cutting carbon emissions from transport doesn't appear to be a local political priority. But there are other factors at play. Zoning is different in America, the engineer Dennis told me. Cities like Columbus have zoning laws so that the mixtures of shops and houses often seen in European suburbs are not allowed here. Up here in the suburbs, it's housing or retail, not both. That makes it a lot harder to live without a car, he explained. I found some glimmers of hope about public transport nearer to the city centre. At the food court in the Polaris Mall, I viewed a huge sepia photo of the handsome Columbus Union Station, boasting a facade like that of the great Gare du Nord railway station in Paris. But Union Station was demolished in 1972 and a convention centre built on its site. That's because the railway lines serving Columbus were closed shortly after the arrival of the interstate highway system in the 50s. A new version of the station may reopen soon, thanks to a federal government infrastructure program. The American passenger railway company Amtrak will, over the next decade, open a new station in Columbus to connect the city with Cincinnati and Cleveland from where passengers will be able to ride onwards to the East Coast. Transport in Columbus appears driven by economic ideology rather than thoughtful planning experts. The trams and railways which once served Columbus were all private enterprises who couldn't compete with the highways and motor cars. Local government, then as now, was not prepared to fund good public transport. Yet there's a contradiction here. It was mostly public money that built the highways to enable the arrival of the motor car, public money that funds roads which facilitate city sprawl. Today, the Republican Party that runs Ohio and Columbus prefers not to raise taxes for better public transport. But thanks to federal money, trains will pull in again at Columbus in 10 years' time. Just don't bank on public transport to get from the train station to the mall in the sprawling suburbs. For World Report, this is Mark Godfrey in Ohio.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.